Hello and welcome to another in the series of our podcast on surrogacy. This is episode 6, and in this episode we're going to focus on solo parenting through surrogacy. I'm joined today by Andrew and Stephen, and we're going to explore today what drew them to surrogacy in the first place, how they've found embarking on their solo journeys so far, and how they see their future should their surrogacy journey be successful. So I'm going to open the floor up to the guys. Andrew, can we start with you, please? And can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm based in Kent, down in Tunbridge Wells. I'm 43, and I started my surrogacy journey back in 2016 when I started looking into it as a solo IP. I'd been single for quite a number of years, and obviously found out that it wasn't legal at the time for parental orders to be granted to single people. So I wrote to my MP and asked him to get it tabled in Parliament. And then everything went a bit quiet because I met a partner, we got together, we dated for a few years, and then COVID happened. And so I kind of put it on the back burner. Then at the beginning of last year, I split up with my partner and thought, well, I'm just going to do it on my own again. So here I am, nearly 18 months on being a member of SUK, and loving the experience, still hoping to find my my oven for my bun.
Thanks, Andrew. Stephen, can we go over to you, please?
Yep, so I'm based in South Wales. My surrogacy journey started back in 2014, and very similar to Andrew, really, is that I contacted Surrogacy UK at the time, and it was a case of, sorry, you're a single AP, the law won't allow it. Went away, very similar again. I met a partner, we were together for about 5 years, and then at the beginning of lockdown, we separated, and it was at that point then that I thought, right, this is the way I want to, this is the direction I want to take with my life now. And that's when I started re-looking into surrogacy.
Thanks, guys. So we've covered a little bit about what drew you into the idea of becoming a parent through surrogacy. I guess the kind of the key thing was, why was it important for you to become a parent, or what made it important enough to decide to embark on this journey by yourself? Stephen, can we go to you first, please?
Yeah, I for a very, very long time, I've known, even in the latter years of school, I've known that I wanted to be a parent. But then it was, you know, growing up with Section 28, and you didn't really see gay parents in media, or it wasn't the way families were at that point in time. So it was a bit of a struggle with trying to battle the feeling of knowing you wanted to be a parent, and the world's against you, and there's that blockage in getting to your dream.
And how about for you, Andrew? Was it a similar kind of, because Stephen's mentioned about kind of the stigma against starting a family in the non-traditional sense. Is that how you found your kind of introduction into, or your idea of parenthood?
Not personally. I've never found there to be a stigmatization or a stigma against me personally, but I do remember when I was around 18 and my brother came out. I've got two older brothers, and one of them's gay, one of them's married to a woman. And I remember thinking to myself, because it brought the kind of issue to my door in a way about what it meant in the future. And I just remember thinking that I'd probably marry a woman to have a family and maybe always be closeted in some way, or, you know, have a non-traditional relationship in some way, shape or form. But I always thought that I'd have to have a family with a woman. And so it wasn't until many, many years later when I suppose I, with the repealing of the sort of Section 28 and civil partnerships and then gay marriage being allowed, I kind of began to realise that actually this idea of normality being so varied that I could actually have a family through in my own right as a gay man, rather than kind of having to live by heterosexual family normatives, if that even is a phrase.
And how did, because obviously you've mentioned, you know, that it even went so far for you as residing yourself to possibly just marrying a woman and as you say, staying closeted for throughout family life potentially. I mean, that must have been a bit of an emotional roller coaster for you to go through that. I mean, was there a lot of, would you say there's a lot of emotional and possibly mental preparedness required to start this journey?
Yes. Yeah. It's difficult to say because I think in my early 20s, I still hadn't really, come out. I didn't come out as a gay man until I was 25. So the idea of family and stuff like that was quite... It was always on the periphery. It was never really something I thought about. I just kind of was getting on with my life. I was focusing on my career, building a world, a friendship base, and going out and enjoying myself. So I didn't even really consciously think about it. And as the time's gone by, I just kind of realised how important it is to me to have a family. My eldest brother sadly can't have children because he went through IVF with his wife and they sadly failed in that. And my gay brother doesn't wish to have a family. And so I don't feel any pressure from my family to have a family, but I'm very conscious that I'm the last in the line of my father's bloodline. And I've always wanted to have a child. My old housemate said, I can't remember a time where you haven't spoken about wanting to have a child. And that's quite nice to hear, that when people tell you, when you speak to them and tell them about your plans for the future and surrogacy and doing it as a solo man, people have sort of been, well, I know that's, you've never spoken any differently. And so it's nice to know that you've got that backup and you just haven't done it just on a whim.
And I love that, the kind of the idea that you're sticking to your convictions, you're sticking to your plan, and I guess, as you said, or you alluded to, the kind of undertone of carrying on the family name and the family bloodline in that sense. I think that's great. How about for you, Stephen? Because obviously you mentioned the non-traditional families, or the non-traditional way of starting a family. How is that kind of, you know, pursuing surrogacy as a single person, how has that affected you on an emotional and possibly even a mental level?
I think I've got quite a close family. So from that perspective, I've had a lot of support, especially from friends and family, quite close to my mum. So they've always been quite supportive of my journey. And they've always known that I've wanted children. Yeah. So we've always had that support from them. So it's never really been a battle from that perspective. But yeah, as an only child, listening to Andrew, then as an only child, I've always had in the back of my mind that if I didn't have children, well, I'm letting them down. And I kept that inside for quite a long time, that, you know, if you know, you're a failure in a way, the feeling of being a failure, that you're not able to carry on your bloodline, unless, of course, you went down the straight route. So when I eventually came out and I've been having conversations with my parents, they were like, you know, we never assumed that you would have children. It was, you know, if you have children, lovely, but if you don't, well, we love you for who you are. So that was nice to hear. So yeah, so I always had a very, very supportive family.
Must have alleviated some pressure as well to hear that, as you say, being an only child.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I think just going back to the sort of mental strain of how surrogacy impacts you and the thought of families, I think the mental strain for me has been self-inflicted in a way. I can remember I've probably spoken to both you and Alex and Stephen about when I first went to the very first surrogacy conference, and I'd only been split up with my partner maybe 2-3 months. And I just walked into a room full of happily married couples, gay, straight, you know, and it was the most triggering experience of my life, realizing that I was there to do the same as them, but I was doing it on my own. And it was so many thoughts of, am I a failure because my relationship's failed? Am I going to be a failure because I'm going to be doing this on my own? Am I absolutely mad and insane to think that I could possibly start this journey? And some of those thoughts haven't really gone away. But the more people I've spoken to about it and sort of opened up to my close circle of friends, they've said, you absolutely can do this. You've got your circle, you've got your family, you've got your network of people that not only can support you physically, but emotionally, mentally, practically. And that's been absolutely invaluable. And then finding that support network within SUK as well, kind of building upon the people that are already there. And you know, having been a year, 18 months into the process, this last month, I've kind of been thinking a lot about what I can do to move myself forward and hopefully find a surrogate. And there's a lot of self-doubt and self-questioning, but I mean, maybe that's good. Maybe it's important to keep thinking, you know, where am I going? What am I going to do?
And we've spoken with numerous couples in the past, this podcast included, about how daunting it can be to go to your first social or to go to your first conference, which is obviously, it's on a much bigger scale and there's a lot more people in attendance than what there would be, you know, to have a surrogacy social, a get together at your local pub. We're talking a conference venue with several hundreds of people. It must be very daunting, as you say, to walk into the room and see all these people, as you say, in couples and knowing that you're there by yourself. But it sounds like you built up some great resilience over those years, or over those 18 months, should I say, within the organization, and kind of stuck to this, I can do this mantra, I guess. Would that be fair to say? Stephen's nodding for starters.
Yeah, I mean, just even just meeting people like Stephen, I mean, I think there's like 20 solo IPs on the Surrogacy UK books. And yes, it's a very small percentage, but it's like a little kind of people go, oh, you're the solo IP. And it's kind of like, oh, that's nice. Nice that people kind of recognize you and at least, you know, have heard of you or whatever. But it's been absolutely invaluable to get that support. And I mean, I'm quite lucky. I think I've met 5 or 6 of the solo IPs just down in the southeast. So, you know, a high percentage of them I kind of have met personally, and it's been good to kind of just sanity check yourself.
Stephen, again, for the benefit of our listeners, you're nodding away there. So you concur with all this and feel the same way.
Absolutely. It's nice to see how the community has grown as well. The single IP community, not just gay men, but women as well, and straight women, and straight men. I'm assuming there must be plenty of them out there that, you know, now that the law has changed, what a wonderful opportunity for people to start their family. So it's nice to see how the community has grown over just this very short space of time.
And as Andrew says, even though there's a small percentage of the community that are solo IPs, I guess it can take as little as one just to have that me too, just to meet somebody in the organization that has that in common, in that they're embarking on the journey as a solo, you know, as a single person as well as you are.
Absolutely. If it wasn't for another solo IP, it was David Watkins in my case, who was a massive help, because I was sort of thrown into this world of surrogacy. And where do you start? There's so much to, you know, I'd done quite a bit of research up to that point, but until you're fully immersed in it, trying to find, you know, what clinic to use and who to speak to, who can give you advice. And, you know, it's great to have that additional support. You know, you might be on your own, but you're not on your own.
I think what Stephen says is absolutely, that's the thing I've found, is that at the end of the day, you can talk to all your friends and your families and your loved ones and your work colleagues and people in SUK and the people you've met at socials. But the decisions come down to you ultimately at the end of it. And it's terrifying because you've got, you know, you're spending tens of thousands of pounds on, you know, medical procedures. And ultimately, the decision comes down to you on your own. And I like to bounce ideas off people, and of course you can bounce them, but the buck stops with me, and it's quite a lonely place to be. No matter how many people who've got your back and who are kind of cheering you on from behind, the success or failure is something that, I guess, even if you're in a couple, you know, if there's something goes wrong with the IVF or the transfer or any part of the pregnancy, ultimately, no matter how many people you've got around you, it's a very lonely experience. And I'm sure that's the case for people in surrogacy or just traditional pregnancies.
And we've spoken, obviously, we've now covered the change in the law. And Andrew, you mentioned, you know, once upon a time having to write to your MP just to get the idea of this on the table. And then we've covered, you know, the pressure that you guys have both felt, being the kind of the last in the bloodline, whether it being an only child or simply having siblings who either have chosen not to or haven't been able to start families. I mean, are there any other hurdles? I mean, I don't want to pile this on. It sounds like that's enough. But Stephen, are there any other hurdles for you in this whole journey that, as I say, you guys, I get the distinct impression that your resilience is just through the roof at this point. You know, is there anything else adverse that you've had to overcome?
The NHS, for one, as fantastic as the service is, it is not. It's not designed for single IPs, unfortunately, and to some extent, it's probably not you know, it's quite a struggle for couples as well. So yes, that's definitely been a big hurdle is all trying to organise tests and things, and you know, you might have tried to in the very early days. I remember reaching out to NHS Wales, and they were like, "Oh, we've never had a single man before. We'd love to help you." And I said, "Well, can I create my embryos elsewhere?" "Oh no, you can't do that." I said, "So I can't create embryos elsewhere and save you money. I've got to create them with you." "Oh yeah. So if you can just find yourself an egg donor and a surrogate at the same time, bring them along and we'll be able to help you." And it's like, yeah, that's not how it works. I obviously it's not as simple as that, but that's how it was phrased at the time. Yeah, it was quite frustrating.
So they were happy to have you as a pioneer, but not overly helpful in that sense.
No.
How about for you, Andrew? Have you, aside from the aspects that we've already covered and discussed, are there any hurdles, any other hurdles, should I say, that you've faced in your journey thus far?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe just my own self procrastination. I found, you know, the kind of, well, I need to tick that box, I need to do this, and I'm just, I mean, I'm in the process of thinking about changing clinics for my embryo creation, and just the sort of daunting nature of thinking, well, what can they offer? And what do they offer? And is there, you know, and there's no, the only reason I'm considering changing is simply because of the size and the scale of the egg bank within the clinic, and just wanting to have a few more options. So there's very little actually in between the practicalities of the clinics. But it's surprising how my own procrastination has sort of waylaid my forward momentum. But I was very lucky. I had some inheritance from a distant family relative who passed away about 6 years ago, and I was able to put some money aside for surrogacy. And I always remember my mum saying to me, "It's so sad that you've got to pay all this money out to have a family, you know, when you know, straight couples can just go to the NHS and get a certain amount of funding." And I said, "I don't look at it like that. I count myself as incredibly lucky that I've been given the opportunity of having some inheritance to achieve my goal. It would be sad if I didn't have that and I couldn't, but I count myself incredibly lucky that I've got that support. I've got that financial income that came in completely out of the blue. So I have to always count the blessings and the gratitudes of this process, because there are so many, and I know there's going to be a lot more in the, you know, in the future. I've not even gone through the embryo creation, never mind transfers and pregnancy. You have to sort of take every step as you're going, and just thank God that it's going forward in the way that I want to." And a friend of mine said to me once, "When will you stop?" And I said, "Well, when the money runs out, I guess, because you know, you can't put yourself into huge swathes of debt chasing a dream that you can never repay. But you know, you've got to be in it to win it as well. You've got to be able to say, I'm going to put some real hard cash and some real hard emotional challenges forward."
And you mentioned procrastination earlier, and obviously I'd like to revisit that, just in the sense that it is one of the main differences between embarking on this on your own versus as a couple, because you will usually, when one person in the couple is having that moment of procrastination, the other person's there to kind of give them that leg up. But it sounds like you've got an absolutely great support network. I mean, Stephen's mentioned his family, but it sounds like between your family and your friends that you mentioned as well, you have got a terrific support network to kind of give you that helping hand and give you that nudge forward should you need it.
Yeah, I'm really lucky. I've got three godchildren, and their parents are from three stages of my life. One was from my secondary school, one was from my uni years, and one was from work. And so I've kind of stayed friends with them for 25 plus years and have watched their children grow up. One godchild is from a lesbian couple who married and had a sperm donor from Sweden. The other two are straight couples, and I count myself lucky that I've been able to be around their families, watching them grow, being part of their development, and realizing that this is something I really want. I don't just want, I want to be involved in their lives. I want to be friends with their parents, and I want, and I love visiting them, and they're all over the country. One's down in Wiltshire, one's up in Nottingham. And it's just fantastic to go and visit them and know that they've got my back as well. You know,
and also, I guess the inspiration, as you said, if you've got friends that are a same sex couple, you know, Stephen spoke earlier about the non-traditional families, to have that, you know, in your circle of friends as well, must be an inspiration, you know, to contributing towards your own journey towards being a parent.
Yeah, and not just the concepts and behind how you start your family, but also listening to them talk about how their children are developing. So at some point they're going to have to talk about the fact that they've got two mums being picked up at the school gate. It's just lovely to know that these 21st century families are coming in all shapes and sizes today. And I'm very lucky that I grew up in a very approving culture. I work in the media, so I've got an approving and accepting kind of workplace and my friends. I do a lot of stuff in the theatre for my hobby. So I haven't really ever encountered opposition or homophobia or any of those kind of challenges that perhaps other gay men have. And so I can focus on the challenges of the emotional side of trying to become a father rather than the societal ones.
And how about for you, Stephen? Because you obviously, we touched upon we've mentioned it a few times now, the non-traditional family unit, and you mentioned how supportive your parents have been in this whole process. I mean, is it the same for you as it is with Andrew? Are you just surrounded by a supportive network of friends as well?
Yeah, I think society's changed as well in that respect, in that it's become more accepting. Is not the right word. It's become that this is the norm, that families are made up of lots of different colors and shapes and sizes, in that it's not just a couple and that's it. It's single dads, single mums, could be two mums, two dads. So I think where I live, I know it's quite a nice, open, quite accepting, shall we say, quite an accepting place to live. And I think society has changed in the last 10 to 15 years in such a way that not many people bat an eyelid now whether how people start their family. That's from my own personal experience, of course. I've no doubt that there are other people out there that might have a contrasting view in that respect. But I always did wonder, if I'm out and about with my child, is somebody going to say, oh, it's dad's day today, is it? And I'm thinking, it's dad's day every day, you know? In fact, one thing I learned from a conference, and I think it was from one of the Allens, that they'd had a conversation with somebody who was in the street, or and maybe it was another family member, about, oh, your child doesn't have a mum. And he said, no, that's not what we're going to teach our children. It's not that they don't have something, but what they have is two dads. It's not so that child then doesn't grow up thinking that they are without something, but they actually, they're the benefit of having two of something else, you know. So that was quite an interesting thing to take away.
That is a great way to look at it. And the sad thing about it is, and we've discussed this in previous podcasts, is that children will just take things on face value, won't they? You know, if you're a child in a less than traditional, shall we say, family unit, it's only when external factors come into play and when somebody else will point that out that kind of thing then has to be dealt with. But yeah, I think that's a terrific way of, you know, the haves versus the have-nots, I think is a great way to look at it. And I mean, it brings me nicely onto my next question, is that you'd mentioned that you personally, Stephen, hadn't encountered any kind of stigma, and you found society to generally be more accepting of things that maybe, you know, as early as in our childhood would have been unacceptable or just bizarre. Have you ever been witness to or faced any societal or cultural stigmas to you personally about wanting to embark on a solo parenting journey through surrogacy?
Personally, no. I don't think I've ever been in a situation where somebody is as but there's the odd Facebook group, you know, when you it's always a keyboard warrior, isn't it? Oh, I you know, don't look for it, and obviously, like you said, you won't see it. So so personally, no, I would like to say that nobody's come up to me and said, oh, you're doing the wrong thing, you know, it's not fair.
It's testament to the accepting society that you've just mentioned, in that even yeah. from early on, and I mean, you mentioned that you've been a part of this journey since 2014. Even back then, you know, we're talking 9 years ago now, it could have been, well, it would have been more than expected when you first said to whoever, you know, the first sort of circle of friends and family, I want to be a parent, but I think I'm going to do it by myself, to have pushback, I guess, would be the best term to use.
Yeah, I think that comes down to maybe the types of people that you surround yourself with. I think a lot of the people that I'm friends with and I socialise with about change in society. So I think I'm blessed in that regard, that I've had very open-minded friends. So yeah, that has been a blessing.
Has that been the same for you, Andrew? I mean, I'm kind of I'm inventing the conversation in my head, specifically as you said, with the same sex friends that you've got. Was there ever a point where they said, you know, we're parents through a sperm donor, and then you replied with, well, I think I'm going to do this by myself?
I think I was more gobsmacked that my friend wanted to become a parent, because she'd shown absolutely no interest in wanting to have kids at any point in the 15 years before I knew her. And her wife somehow persuaded her. I think she said, well, I'll carry the kids. And but I was just so. No one's really ever said to me, sort of sounded, well, I suppose they have sounded surprised, but more in a kind of, wow, that's amazing. I can only think of one specific example where I've come across a slightly negative viewpoint. And actually, it was someone that I was talking to on a dating app. And I have a Hinge profile, and I've put on there as one of my things, something you should know about me is I intend to become a father through surrogacy. And I'm just like, I'm not prepared to start dating someone if they're not even aware of that, because I've gone on a few dates in the past where it's come up. And I sort of think to myself, I had a great time, got on really well with this person. At the end, I remember one person saying to me, what are you doing this weekend? I said, oh, I'm going to a surrogacy social. And he went, I don't want to have kids. And it was just, it was soul destroying. Anyway, this chap I was talking to on the app, he said to me, why aren't you considering adoption? And I said, well, I've just always wanted my own biological child. I can't really ever think of a time that I haven't. And he said, he didn't quite say this, but this was the implication, was that, well, having a child is ecologically and environmentally quite a burden on the environment. I'm going to adopt a child to reduce the sort of carbon footprint of a baby. And I thought, oh my God, that's a mental thought process. And I remember thinking, I felt quite wounded and quite attacked, that just the fact that I wanted to have a child by my own genetics was somehow, you know, creating a sort of burden on the planet. And and I spoke to a very dear friend of mine who actually developed one of the carbon calculators that is used in television production, so the kind of industry standard thing. And I said, what is the science behind this? And he said, yes, actually, unless you're someone like Greta Thunberg, you know, the sort of the carbon emissions involved in creating new life and then their output over the course of their life is going to have a massive impact on the planet. But he said, I'd be a massive hypocrite if I stood here and said, you should go and adopt a child. He said, because me and my wife never discussed that. We just had our own child. And I am very pleased he had the honesty and sort of the sort of truthfulness to say to me, you have to follow your path, no matter what it is. It was something, it came completely left field. And that's the only time I've ever really experienced any negativity. And it was someone I barely knew. So it hasn't, It hasn't impacted me a massive amount, but it's certainly opened my eyes up to that question and how I would answer it in the future.
And we've had this discussion numerous times in this community about how IPs always seem to get that same response in that, well, why would you go down the surrogacy route? Why don't you just adopt? You know, there are children that need adopting. And it's never asked of a couple who have had two or three children just in the normal sense. I'm using that with air quotes for our listeners. Mm-hmm. And they decide they want a third or a fourth. And it's never, well, you've got three children already, or you've got two children already. Why don't you try adopting one? You know, it's just never... It's never put out there for them, is it?
I think I've heard quite a few people say now as a stock response, it's like, well, did you consider it when you were starting a family? And it's sort of a way of just spinning the question back. And if they say no, then they've got their answer. And if they say yes, then you can just carry the conversation on. But it's quite an accusatory sort of conversation, is it? It's like, well, you as a gay man have responsibility for clearing up. That's a kind of cliche, isn't it? And you think, well, no, it's not just my responsibility. That's society's responsibility, not just gay men or children, parents that can't have children through traditional means.
Absolutely. And I mean, we spoke, this kind of goes hand in hand. And Stephen, I think it was you that alluded to it earlier. You mentioned the daddy day and well, where's mum today and that kind of thing. And we do often discuss with people in the surrogacy community, specifically same-sex couples, about the quote-unquote children need a mother. You know, and that quote that always seems to get bandied around for a same-sex couple. I mean, how would you respond, not necessarily to that, but how would you respond to people who say that children need two parents?
Again, it's one of those very outdated opinions, isn't it? That maybe there's a certain demographic in society that might still have that belief that all families should be that a man and a woman, and that's what Adam and Eve did. And you know, if when you look at the statistics of children that actually are in single parent families, and you know, might be just one mum or one dad, and go on to live quite and become quite well-rounded members of society, it's, you know, it becomes a non-question, really, because it doesn't make a difference in the end. It all comes down to love at the end of the day. And I think as long as a child is loved and has that support, that family support, whatever shape or form that takes, it's irrelevant whether they have a mum and a dad or one or two or whatever, you know. Yeah.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Andrew?
I think, I mean, look at different cultures and, you know, families come in so many different shapes and forms. You know, you'll find yourself in an Indian culture, a Muslim culture, the you know, multiple generations living in the same home. And the expectation is that they would be raised by any number of grandparents, aunts and uncles. So who's to say by, you know, sort of Western thought processes, there's just, you know, a mum and a dad is enough. I was very lucky that my mum went back to work when I was 6 weeks old, and I was cared for by my grandparents 2 days a week from the age of 6 weeks. So, you know, I actually count myself very lucky that I had a different viewpoint in the world. And yes, I had a mum and dad. Sometimes I don't know how much practical parenting my dad did in my early years. I mean, I have no idea if he changed my nappies. I'm sure he did. You know, I know my mum will be listening to this and cursing me, saying, you can't speak about your father like that. But, you know, he certainly wasn't a hands-on dad like I know dads are these days. I'm sure he was amazing when I was a kid, but I suspect there was lots of stuff he didn't do that modern parents and fathers would do today. There, put it out there.
So we've spoken before about the whole, and I think it was it was around the same sex conversation, I'm sure, around the, you know, some children may have a favorite aunt or a favorite grandmother. It doesn't need to be a biological mother, does it?
My two lesbian friends have two girls and one boy. And so every so often I get a text from my friend says, you know, what do I do about Eddie's penis? What do I do about, you know, what about this? And you know, some people could say, well, you know, the chances are a woman is not going to have the question thrown at them, where's dad, if they're out and about. So we just know that society is much more tuned into seeing women walk around with a pushchair or a pram and a child. But there is a point that comes that, you know, my friends have no experience or very little experience of that part of physiology. And so I get asked and I'm honoured that they turn to me to ask those questions. And likewise, if I have a girl, I'll be doing the same to them. So it swings around about us, isn't it, really?
And it's also, you know, I mean, there's the assumption as well that by having... I mean, I'm going to use the example of a mother, but by having a second parent in the case of you guys, this other person's not going to be an oracle on parenting, are they? They're going to know as much or as little about it, chances are, that you guys do. So as you said there, you know, you will reach out to somebody. It could be, you know, somebody that you know. It could just be as simple as a search engine, you know, and you will find the answer, won't you, to whatever it needs to be. And it is that, you know, when there is that, as Stephen alluded to that brilliant answer earlier, focusing on the haves rather than the have-nots, you know, you aren't going to be living in a bubble. You will be able to reach out in some way, sense or form and get the answer from somebody experienced without having to have that person immediately connected to your family unit and then that child.
I mean, this is a very male-centric conversation. You've got two gay men here, and of course, you know, surrogacy is gonna take all sorts of females that, you know, that can't have children for whatever reason, and they're gonna run into the same problems. That, you know, they won't have had a baby. They, for whatever reason, they can't have a child. Maybe they had cancer, or maybe they were born without a womb, or any number of reasons that dictate that they can't possibly know what it's like to be a parent, and it's no different for them as it is for us. It's just that biologically gay, that men can't carry a child.
Again, that's where the benefit of this community comes in as well, isn't it? Because while we're all coming at it from a different perspective, we've got each other to talk to and say, you know, I've been in this situation today. What would you have done if you were in that situation? And at least you've got somebody to bounce ideas off.
And I think seeing other people's bravery as well, that is that's part of what's kept me going, is realizing that, you know, there's so much, people have gone through so much adversity emotionally or physically or whatever. And then you just pick up people's stories and you go, wow, if they can survive this and move forward, I can do it. And sometimes just the support comes without you even knowing it. It's not even like you're reaching out and asking for it. Sometimes it just comes from reading someone's diary or seeing that they've had a shitty day, or, you know.
And it's a fantastic point that you've just made there as well, Stephen, is that, and it's what we try and advocate at socials and at conferences, is make friends, you know, make friends in IPs. Don't just go out looking for a surrogate. Gather that tribe of people that will be able to share the experiences and share the knowledge with you, so that if, you know, if you can't find the answer within your close circle of family or friends, you can speak to somebody within the community and get, again, going back to the Me Too story, you know, has anybody else been through this? Has anybody else experienced this? And you will absolutely get somebody back, come back and say, yeah, we went through this and here's how we dealt with it. And you can find your answer by going down that avenue as well, can't you?
Absolutely.
I'm going to take the conversation in a slightly different direction now. Obviously, we've covered a lot about, you know, your journeys thus far and your experiences. We've covered some of the hurdles and the adversity and some of the emotional barriers that you've both had to endure and overcome, and we've spoken a lot about resilience as well. But I'm going to move into kind of a forecasting area of the conversation now, and Andrew, I think we'll start with you, because you mentioned about not having been through the embryo creation process and any of that part of it yet, but I'm gonna try and encourage you to fast forward slightly further than that and ask you, what do you envisage your relationship with your surrogate to be like?
I remember when I first wrote my profile text, I kind of answered that question, and I can't remember what I put, so I'm gonna have to think about where I am at the moment. I was very lucky about 10 years ago to have a conversation with a dear friend of mine who said to me, I would love to be your surrogate. And this was long before I had really seriously thought about it, but it was obviously in the back of my mind because I'd obviously talked about it. But our timescales didn't align. I was not ready to be a father. And by the time I'd kind of thought about it, she was not ready to be, she was too far down the process to be pregnant again. But I've always held on to the friendship that she and I have, in that when I see her, it's like being, it's like no time has passed. We're not best friends. We're not living in each other's pockets. But when I see her, she remembers what I've done. She'll ask about my family. And the same is back, you know, we communicate on Facebook and comment on each other's profiles. And I, the visceral friendship that we have is what I would love to have with a surrogate. It's something that is really important to me, and it totally aligned with the ethos of SUK, that this person could have been a friend and a surrogate to my child. And it absolutely 100% fits in with SUK's friendship first idea. So that's what I want to find. I want to find someone that is on the end of the phone when we need it, but we don't have to be living in each other's lives all the time. I just think that kind of, almost like you know what's going on in their life, even if you don't, but you kind of have a sense of it. I'm not even sure if I'm making sense, but when you think of someone, sometimes when you think of a friend that you haven't seen for a while and you just have a lovely warm feeling about them, and I think I definitely want to find someone that is always going to have each other's best interests at heart, no matter where you are in your life. And if it's a tough time, you'll be there for them, much more engaging. And if it's not, and they just want to get on with their life, then great. And you kind of wish them best and run along with each other.
Wow. I don't think I was expecting the answer to be quite as poetic as that. And you said, I hope this makes sense. And for our listeners, Stephen and I were both nodding along to pretty much every point of that as well. Right, so Stephen, the bar has been set. I'm going to give you, because this was a two-part question, so you're going to have plenty of time to think about your answer while I pitch the second part of my question to Andrew. So we've covered what you think your relationship to your surrogate would be like. How do you plan to involve the surrogate in your child's life, and what role do you think they play with this, bearing this kind of, this person that's always on the end of the phone but not necessarily in your pocket?
Oh God, I just want to have fun. I just want to have fun in life. I feel like I've been such a grown-up recently and kind of just bloody miserable. And I just want to, I want to go to a theme park. I want to, you know, I want to be going round for tea or them come round for a movie night. And there's nothing nicer than going to my godchildren's house and engaging with them, playing with their toys, talking to their mums and their dads, and having a coffee and being interrupted, and then there being a tantrum and then having to talk them down off that. I love every element of being in my friends' family circles, and that's what I want. I want to be part of their life. I mean, it sounds a bit kind of broad and a bit vague, but God, it's when I think about going to visit my friends, that's how I think about my surrogacy future, the relationship I have with a surrogate and their family, because I don't have a massively close family with a second generation or a third generation, should I say. So there are no children in my families, in my immediate family circle. But my friends, by God, I just love it. I love going and engaging with them. So I want to have that. I want to have lots of fun, and Christmas to be a time of, you know, stupid games and silly hats and jumpers and, you know, mess and noise. And, you know, yes, I'm going to whinge about it. But that's what I want. I want just a bloody good laugh.
There we have it. So for any potential surrogates listening to this podcast, be prepared for theme parks, movie nights and Christmas games in Andrew's house.
Board games. Yes, God, board games.
Yeah.
Love them.
Frustrating board games. Monopoly. Yeah. Monopoly afoot. Right, so Stephen, I hope you've been taking plenty of notes, because I'm now going to pitch this two-part question back to you. We're going to rewind this a bit and go back to you. So first part of the question was, what do you envisage your relationship with your surrogate to be like?
So I always imagined that the surrogate would be an auntie in the life of my child, somebody who would or children, somebody who would, you know, be there. The child would know their origins, you know, where they came from. And I had quite a small family growing up. I knew there were lots of cousins and other members of the family around as a child, but it always seemed that it was just me and my parents. So I definitely want my child to have that sense of community around them, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And how do you plan to involve the surrogate in your child's life? You've mentioned that they'll possibly be the role of auntie, and it's definitely the preferred, or one of the preferred terms that I've heard from all the surrogates that I've interviewed. But yeah, so can you elaborate on the part of the auntie, if you like, in your child's life?
Someone who is at the end of the phone when you need them. Someone who you know you go on surprise visits, days out. Somebody who's there maybe at Christmas time or birthdays or catch up weekends, that sort of thing. I suppose it all comes down to where your surrogate, where auntie lives, doesn't it? You know, it's, you know, if they're down the road, you know, they might be in your life every day, once a week, once a month. But if they're a little bit further down the road, you might be in that unfortunate situation, whereas it's, you know, once every quarter, or, you know, two or three times a year. But definitely somebody who's at the end of the phone or on a Zoom, you know, Zoom is now the way that, like, people can communicate further afield. So yeah.
No, that's great. And thank you for answering my two-part question. But unfortunately, I'm now going to put you completely on the spot, because I'm not going to give you the prep time. Prep time now goes to Andrew for this next question, which is, how do you envisage your life and the life of your child when the surrogacy process is complete?
I try and envisage life.
This is a loaded with hope question. And obviously we have everything yeah, crossed for both you guys. But, you know, assuming you complete your surrogacy journey successfully.
Yeah, plain sailing, that'd be nice, you know, easy, you know, sleep well at night, and, you know, easy. I imagine that probably won't be the case, will it, let's be honest, but a healthy child and all the fun and games that come along with that. Like what we said about earlier on, it's going to be a learning curve, isn't it? So family, friends, support, and hopefully we'll muddle along.
Well, I can tell you now that if you do get a plain sailing kind of end to your journey, or new chapter, should I say, to your surrogacy journey, if your surrogate is a parent herself, then they will absolutely hate you for having a plain sailing, a plain sailing introduction to parenthood.
I think the plain sailing would, you know, considering that the journey that you have to go along to get to that point in time, I think probably anything is plain sailing thereafter. So,
no, well said. I think that is true. Yeah. What about for you, Andrew? How do you envisage your life and the life of your child when your surrogacy process is complete, or should I say, reaches a fingers crossed successful completion for you?
I want it to be full of exploration. I just imagine myself going for a walk through the woods and sort of talking to my child about what that bird is that we've seen, or what that tree is. And, you know, the idea that we can learn about nature together and explore new places and go and find abandoned castles or buildings, you know, the remains of something in a woodland forest, or playing poo sticks, you know, on the bridge. Just that sort of muddy wellies, jumping in a puddle and having a good laugh, and that's what I can picture it so clearly in my head. A sort of 2 or 3 year old, where they're just starting to engage and have a little personality, and yes, I know they're the terrible twos and the tantrum threes or whatever, but that's when they become little people, when they're not just sort of totally reliant on you. They sort of have their own inquisitiveness. That's what I exploring. Yeah.
Sounds like a Hallmark lifetime of adventure is what you is what you have in store.
In reality, it'll be running to the bus or something like that, and screaming at each other, and ice cream dribbling down their t-shirt.
As Stephen rightly said, after getting that far, you'd revel in that kind of thing, wouldn't you?
Mm. Yeah,
I was going to say that there's something quite heartwarming about. You might be doing something for the 20th time, but you're witnessing somebody else do it for the first time. And there's, you know, seeing that in, you know, potentially in their eyes. And
So we're going to wrap up this podcast and bring it to a close with my final question. And I'll pitch this one to you first, Andrew. So what advice would you give to other single individuals looking to become parents through surrogacy?
Just keep going. Just keep taking one step after another. Believe in yourself. Because you have to have total faith, even in your darkest hours and your darkest days, when you think, what on earth am I doing? You've come this far. And yes, maybe you will realise that it's not the right journey for you. But if that's the case, then you've made the right decision. But I can just say, use the resources around you. Open up to people, be honest. I don't like having small talk conversations. I'd far rather within 5 minutes of meeting someone say, I'm going through surrogacy, or I've got a terrible health problem, or I'm having, you know, anything. I'd rather talk about something big in my life and something real in my life. And so draw on those relationships you have, draw on that support network and just keep going.
What about for you, Stephen? What advice would you like to impart to others?
It's not plain sailing. be seen, ask questions. There is a community out there. You're not alone. There are other people there that will be able to help and assist. If there's any information that you know you're struggling to get answers to, ask the questions, ask those hard questions, and especially when it comes to clinics. You know, don't be afraid to ask awkward questions, because you know if you don't get it right at the beginning, one thing I found is, especially with clinics and their administration from that point of view, is that if you don't ask the questions at the beginning, you might miss something along the lines. And if it's just you on your own, nobody else could potentially assist you from that point of view, unless you open up and you ask the community, Surrogacy UK, other people within our community for that assistance. So don't feel that you are alone, because you're not. There are plenty of people out there that can help.
Because it is still new, isn't it? You know, single parental order has only been around for 4 years. So, I mean, goodness knows how many people have actually, you know, become single parents in that time. I have no idea, but I can't imagine it's loads.
Despite the law having changed, there are still clinics that are fumbling their way around the law. Mm. And it's trying to find that good practice, and then you can share that on with others.
We're the trailblazers.
And sound advice from you trailblazers as well, I'd say. So I'd like to thank you both. From our listeners' point of view, we hope you found this as engaging and rewarding as we have found making it. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrew and Stephen, for coming along and sharing their experiences so far. Obviously, we wish you the best in your surrogacy journey moving forward. And if you are listening to this podcast and you're interested in embarking on a surrogacy journey yourself from whatever angle, you can find as much information as you need via surrogacyuk.org. And we certainly hope you'll join us again for the next episode in this series of podcasts. Thank you very much.